Hello, listeners. Before we get to the show, I'd like to tell you about an event that we're planning in Houston, Texas on July 9th. Ryan, you want to tell people about it?
Well, if you're a listener of the show, you know that me and Tate go buy real estate. Well, we are going to lift up the tent and show you all the details on how we find properties, select sites, conduct due diligence, and we're actually going to do a bus tour in Houston, Texas on Wednesday, July 9th from 12 to 4. And then after, we're going to have a happy hour at Tall Yard Brewing in Sugar Land, Texas, which is just south of Houston at 4:30. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So you can come meet other investors for a day of learning. We've set the time so that you can fly in and fly out same day from any coast or hub city. So I'm excited to invite our listeners. Come meet me and Tate. Come see us do property due diligence, learn about self-storage investing, learn about real estate investing, meet other investors. So I'm excited. But Tate, back to you.
It's going to be a lot of fun. You can come for the bus tour. You can come for the happy hour. You can come to both. We hope to see you there. Go to passiveincomepilots.com/Houston to RSVP.
Space is limited. See you soon.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here on another week of financial education. Ryan, what's up, man?
Not much. Thanks for jumping on. I'm excited to see you again, Tate.
Excited to see you. We're going to be in Houston in a week, right? On that bus tour, doing a little due diligence education. For those of you that signed up, thank you. We're looking forward to seeing you. That'll be really fun. There's only 50 spots on that bus and we're completely full, right?
I think we have like one spot left, maybe.
Okay. But the golden
I think it's
ticket,
full.
Willy Wonka.
join the standby list. We're going to, you know, you'll see if your number's called. No, I'm just joking. No pilots left behind.
You can always Uber from one property to the next if you're, you know.
We've got a Suburban rented that day. So if anybody really wants a ride around, we're going to have one trailing the bus event. So if anybody really wants to go and hasn't been confirmed, let us know. We got a seat for you. We're going to accommodate everybody.
Well, and regardless of the bus tour, whether you're coming or you're not, Houston, Texas, at Tall Yard Brewing, 4:30 p.m. on July 9th. That's in 1 week. Come check us out. We've got open bar for three. I just put the card down, the Passive Income Pilots card this morning. So come drink some beers on us.
Getting our points, right?
That's right. And it'll be a really good time. There's going to be at least 40 or 50 people there, like-minded investors. Come on down if you have to jump seat out and Zed home because you've had a few beers. You can always do that.
You know what's cool? Like people always ask Tate and I, like, hey, how does this work? How do your investments work? And how can I give you money? You know, does it go into one property? Does it go in several properties? And I think what's cool about this bus tour is, you know, we did a happy hour before, but it was kind of like everybody had a happy hour and we didn't really do anything but hang out and talk and it was fun. But now we're going to actually show you where your money goes, how it's spent, how a pro forma is done, where the, you know, how we look at property, how we do due diligence. So very excited about that. But if you didn't make it or you can't make it, this episode is actually going to be, I think this conversation that we're going to have today is kind of a good primer for those that are going on the trip or are not going on the trip. And we're going to talk about all the things that Tate and I think about when we buy real estate and how people kind of participate, how it actually works. Because, you know, 10 years ago, I was flying for the regionals and we were starting to make some money and put some money away. And we had tons of money in the stock market. My wife looks at me and she goes, why don't we do some of this real estate stuff? You know, not like own rental properties, but like, what about these crowdfunding platforms or the syndications? And she's like, what do you think about that? And I was just like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I have no idea how that works. And so I didn't even know where to start. And I think that's why I'm excited to talk to Tate about it. Tate, did you have a similar experience when you were kind of getting into this?
Absolutely. I was just on another podcast and they were asking, what do you wish that you knew earlier? And I said, I wish I would have gotten networked earlier. I wish I would have known more people earlier because I was firing shots in the dark. You know, I was buying real estate, but I wasn't buying very good real estate. And it wasn't until I started going to some conferences and some meetups and really building a network, a friendship network, a professional network within the real estate industry that things just started catching fire. And, you know, real estate investing is a team sport. So if you're going to be solo, hopefully you find a good operator. You know, you found Ryan and I, so congratulations. Yeah, you know, we're honest people that have been in the business for a long time, but it can be very difficult when you're starting out to know what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. There's some shady people out there that might, you know, run off with your money. There's some really good operators that have stubbed their toe, like we were talking about before the show. Best operator in the world, if they buy the wrong property, the wrong time, the wrong market cycle, it's not going to go well. Doesn't matter how hard you operate it. Understanding all of this context, building community around it. So that's why I think it'll be so much fun having this Passive Income Pilots happy hour and the bus tour, chance to build that network, build the context, take some numbers off of a spreadsheet and actually see them living, breathing in real life.
I love that. And I think this actually will tie really nicely into, now, let's talk about the Houston deal, but not in terms of, you know, why you should invest, but how you invest, like how this whole thing kind of comes together, right?
I think that's what we wanted to break down today on this episode is sort of a how-to. I get asked a lot of times by people who are just getting into this, and I know that a lot of our listeners have already made, you know, a number of LP investments, but if you haven't, a question that comes up for me a lot is, so what, I just give you $50,000 and Turbine Capital decides what to do with it? And it's like, absolutely not. We're not financial advisors. We don't take a big chunk of money and then, you know, invest it on your behalf. We have opportunities that we curate and vet. And if you so choose, you can come along for the ride. So we're going to break down how that works, how the process of investing works, what an accreditation letter is, what an accredited investor is today, a little bit of titling subscription agreements and what's a PPM. So without further ado, how about we jump in? Ryan?
Let's do it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
So the first question as to, you know, does Spartan decide where someone's money goes? Let's crack that one up first.
Yeah, so no. We're not financial advisors. We're not even fiduciaries of your investment. So right. Technically, we are just an operating company that goes out and finds real property. And we package it up and we say, hey, here's the opportunity. Do you want to be a partner in it? And there's the GP, which is us, the general partner. And then there's LPs, which are limited partners, which is the investor. And by virtue of how it's stated, you are a limited partner, meaning you have limits of your liability. So we pick a very specific property and say, well, do you want to participate? So in the Houston offering, it's 7 properties in the Houston market. And it's those 7 properties and those 7 properties only. And I think the question I get a lot too, Tate, is like, do I get 1 of the 7 or do I get all of the 7? And the answer is right. You get all of the 7. You get all 7 properties. And each property is going to have its own income and losses. And then all those, and those are called P&Ls, profit and loss statements. And all those P&Ls are going to roll up to one master consolidated P&L for the whole portfolio. And that's kind of how we make decisions on how much cash to give you as the LP when there's income and things like that.
Perfect. Yeah. And if I can tack on to that, you know, if you are a listener, you're going to go out and buy a rental property. You're going to use your own money to buy it. Well, times that by 1,000. Well, you don't have enough money to do that on your own. The Houston deal, what is it, $108 million purchase?
$102 million purchase
$102 million. So bucks. I don't think anybody listening to this show, maybe, but I don't think anybody listening to this show has quite enough money to, or if you did, you wouldn't want to put all your eggs into that basket, right? So what Ryan does, what we do is we go out, we find excellent deals that we want to invest in. And then the next step is structuring the capital, right? So you're going to have to structure the debt and structure the equity. And the investors are the equity. So the equity investors are the down payment and the bank is going to lend the rest of the money. And then we go to work and operate that deal for a period of time. And we look to exit at some point in the future for a sale and a profit.
Let's rewind the clocks back and let's talk about the story of how this deal even comes together, right? So, you know, we have a business with people that work in acquisitions and they go out and find these properties. They're going to conferences, traveling the country, meeting with brokers. I actually met with a broker this morning and met for 2 hours to talk about Washington State deals. And so we and the team invest a lot of time and effort in these relationships. And then when these deals come up, we have a team that analyzes the deal to make sure that it actually is hitting the returns. And then we'll put up what's called an LOI, letter of intent. We'll put these properties under some kind of a non-binding agreement. And then once we inspect them, like I've been to personally to all these properties, then we'll do what's called a purchase and sales agreement, which basically says that we're going to buy the property for a defined price under defined conditions. And then we say, okay, now we're going to go market this offering to investors. And so that's where you, the investor, comes in, is we send you what's called an offering memorandum. And that offering memorandum is going to list out the highlights of the deal. It's a pamphlet. It's a brochure. It's a flyer. Exactly. And I think that's a key thing, is to understand that that marketing material is not a legally binding document. It's literally just a flyer for the investment. And you know, we can transition into all the documents that go into some kind of offering, but Tate, go ahead and jump in.
Before we transition to the legal documents and all that sort of stuff, I just want to harp on the GPLP structure nature of this. What I love about the GPLP structure, and this is what I always attracted to me to limited partner investing, is that you have general partners, you have limited partners, you're all on the same aircraft. So when the general partners make money, the limited partners make money, and vice versa. And it's not like a, you know, I hate to be a downer on financial advisors. I have some great financial advisors in my life, but they make a 1% fee on that portfolio, whether the value goes up or the value goes down. And, you know, they're going to do the best they can. Those are fiduciaries. Those are financial advisors that have to put your best interest first, but their goal is to expand the number of dollars that are under management so that they can get a fee from a larger pool of money. Whereas an operator who's out there trying to find the best real estate deals they can are very aligned, because the better deal that they can find and the better way that they can operate it is going to make more money for everyone, because there's a split at the end of the day where the investors are taking home a majority portion of the profits. So I just wanted to point that out as investors are thinking about the difference between, you know, let's say a mutual fund where you're looking at like a fee and going, well, I want to get the lowest fee possible mutual fund. Whereas in the operation space, you're looking for the best team possible, that's most capable to go out and take down this private deal that's not available to the general public.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add to that is, you know, to make sure the operator is going to take some kind of acquisition fee upfront. So the operator is going to take some money. And I think, you know, there's a really good reason. You know, let me tell you a story about a time where I invested with an operator, my very first syndication. And they didn't charge any fees. There was no construction management fee. There was no acquisition fee. There was nothing. They were taking no fees, and they just said, nope, we're just going to do this deal. And, you know, we're doing is taking a split just like you at the end. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, well, that's awesome great. That you don't take fees.
Yeah. Cause now you're just focused on making us all money and we split it at the end. Right.
Yeah.
But there is the problem.
That was 7 years ago, and they still haven't finished the property. Actually, I take that back. I think the property is finally finished, but like it's like a half done property. And every single time I went to that property and just kind of like drove by, I would see my sponsor there, my operator, and he would be in a hole in a trench digging the ditch alongside of his hired help. And this is why it took 7 years to build something that I can build in 10 months, because he had no job. He had no way to produce income. And so I think these acquisition fees get kind of a bad name in the industry. I think people go, oh, well, you know, you're charging a big acquisition fee. I don't really care what the operator charges as an acquisition fee. I'm going to be the contrarian to the industry and just say, I care about how they spend it. You know, do they actually have a team that they're using that acquisition fee to pay? Like, you know, an operator as a man, you know, not as a fund, but as an operator, you'd expect to see some kind of asset manager, a really strong CFO that is running the company that has a pedigree. You know, usually that person has worked for one of the big three accounting firms or publicly traded REIT. You'd want to see an asset manager who's had some kind of experience managing like a multi-million-dollar, you know, $100 million portfolio. You would want to have, you know, a chief executives at the business, you know, outside of just the partners that are running the company. And you'd want to see some meat in the executive leadership team. If it's a one-man guy sort of doing deals, and
right.
I just, you know, it gets it gets hard when the operator doesn't actually have any type of executive leadership team. So that would be my first like red flag. If there was a fee, but no backbone behind it.
Big time. Well, let's also talk about when a deal goes sideways, because if a deal goes sideways and there's no fee, you can't keep the lights on. You can't keep people employed to keep working a deal to get it out of the slump. There has to be some sort of fees to keep oil in the machine and people working.
Yeah. And I think these fees are, you know, it's a good transition to the legal documents. And I know I don't want to bore people with the legal documents, but you know, when you have a single family home, right? You buy a single family home, you're going to hire a property management company. Guess what? That property management company is going to charge you up to 10% of their gross receipts from the rent, right? You get a property and you get $1,000 a month in rent and you hire a property manager, they're going to take 10%. They're going to take $100 a month. Maybe they take less, maybe they take more. I don't know. It depends on your situation, but they're going to take $100 a month. In my company, I do the same thing. I charge a 5 or 6% property management fee because I've got to have a SVP of operations, director of operations, regional district managers that are not covered by the property expense. So I think when you start getting into this space, there's going to be fees charged, and it's important to kind of understand where each one is going.
It's also important to note that when we underwrite these deals and we project out, hey, we think it's going to be, let's say, a 15% annualized return when we're all said and done, that's net of all fees and
that's
net of all splits. Yeah. So what you see is what you get in terms of course, those are just projections. And the moment the deal closes, those are going to be wrong. Those are best guesses, but that's net of all fees.
I'm really glad you said that because that's an important factor. So the thing that everybody signs, you know, so if you say, okay, I want to do this deal in Houston, let's just say, and I want to put in $100,000, you know, now what? Right. And so, you know, you went on the bus tour, you see all these properties, you're like, this is a great project, I want to move forward. What you would do typically, what you could come to expect is you go on some kind of a portal or a dashboard that the operator provides, like Turbine Capital provides a great dashboard. Spartan has the same thing. And you'd go on there and you got to sign some documents. And the documents are really attesting that you understand and have agreed to the terms of the deal. And there's no like typically not any debt obligations or things like that. But the subscription agreement is what you sign. And the subscription agreement basically says you've read everything. And it's important to understand what those documents say and what they are. So typically in a syndication, there's something called a PPM. And that's a private placement memorandum. All this is not the marketing document. This is the actual thing that matters.
Three things, and it'll usually be combined in one long document, so 100 pages plus. And you just see it all in one thing as you're going through and signing, but there's a PPM, an operating agreement, and a subscription agreement. So just to outline that we're talking about these three. So you want to dig into the PPM?
Yeah. I mean, this is going to be your risk factors. This is going to be the outline of the deal, the raise amount, the min, the max, the potential risks, liquidity risks, operational risk issues. It's going to be the background on the issuer should be in there, the principals, the management team, the track record. It's a legal document that basically tells you all of your risks. And I like to say the PPM is really kind of like that. It's the FARs, right, of the aviation world, right? So, you know, you might have, a checklist or whatever it is that your airline issues you, but your PPM is your FARs. That they are the rules of the road. And these are the legal disclosures where the real brass tacks is and what the operator can and cannot do and what you're entitled to as an investor. And so, but I wouldn't be so excited about reading the PPM and finding things that are in your benefit. Let's just be completely honest. Yeah. The PPM is really to protect the issuer or the operator, me, because the PPM is basically saying, hey, you could lose all your money. And here's 25 ways that this investment can go wrong. You know, we can have competition, we can have government, we can have taxes, we can have failures, we could have low demand, we could have weaker than projected rents. The list goes on and on and on. So
key I always kind of risk.
Yeah, there's key man risk. You know, I could get hit by a bus or whatever it is. And so that document basically says the doomsday scenario. And the analogy that somebody gave me, and a syndication attorney gave me, is when you sit down for a surgery, and just before the surgery operation begins, they hand you a clipboard with a little thing to sign, and it says, you can die. That's basically the PPM.
Right, so, right. And if the offering memorandum is all the things that could go right, and it's the, you know, big, shiny, flashy flyer, the PPM is all the things that could go wrong, and it's the legalese. But I love that with the surgery analogy, because if you're new to this and you're looking through a PPM and you're kind of scared, it's, you know, you kind of have to read between the lines.
That's actually a really good framing, because are you going to still do the surgery just because it says you could die and it's not their fault? Well, yeah, you're going to do the surgery, but the doctor is the one that you've put your trust in, right? And their pedigree and their background and their experience. So you're not going to do surgery with someone you just met yesterday. Like, that's what I don't recommend doing, right? I would say that surgeon's going to come referred and has a good reputation, and you're going to do some research, and you're going to take the time to sort of make sure this person is legitimate. And too many times I will raise my hand and say, I am guilty. People go give their money to somebody who has not done, has not been vetted. Right. And so, you know, when I was an airline pilot, and 10 years ago, and I'm going from a regional to a major, and I have this awesome opportunity to roll my 401k into a self-directed IRA, because I read about it in a book. And so I get this money, and it's loaded in the gun, and it's like the next person who walks in the room is getting my money. And this guy that walked in the room, I was convinced was, you know, a flashy sales guy. And I was like, I think I got to read this PPM. And he goes, oh, I don't read, don't bother with that. There's nothing. I don't even know what they said in there. And that was kind of red flag number one. But, you know, he's in jail now. He ran off with our money. And right. So you just gotta kind of, like, in this world, slow down.
Well, and this comes full circle to the network and community aspect. And this is the whole reason we started this show, was to provide access and context within the industry so that you can understand, and so that you can be more networked.
Exactly. But that
was a great explanation of what a PPM is. Let's move on to the operating agreement.
Yeah. So the operating agreement is your FOM. So that is the rules of the organization, the rules of the company. It's the what the management can do, what the management can't do. It's the rights of the members. And, you know, is there voting rights? Does it take majority, which is usually half, or does it take supermajority, which is more than that? And, you know, what rights do you have? And, you know, how are things divvied up? How are tax losses and gains split among the members? And to be honest with you, a lot of the PPM is usually the same as the operating agreement, the OA. And, you know, it's a lot of similar language. They're going to really kind of talk to each other. When we put together our legal documents, the PPM and the operating agreement literally are born at the same time. And, but it's a little bit more legally binding document, and the PPM is sort of the one-time upfront disclosure. And then things sort of transition to the operating agreement, and the operating agreement is kind of how you function as a business. But I did want to jump back to the PPM real quick, because if you're wondering what fees the operator gets or the issuer gets, is all the fees should be disclosed in the PPM. And there should never be any fees that I make or Tate makes or whatever that are not disclosed in the PPM. So that's where you're gonna see a schedule of fees and all the which ways we can make money. That's a big deal. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Next, the subscription agreement. And this is one that kind of gets people sometimes because there's titling issues. So let's talk about the subscription agreement, and then I'm happy to talk through some of the ways, all those little boxes that you'll see that you'll have to check. So Ryan, what's the subscription agreement?
Yeah. So the subscription agreement is basically attesting that you've read the PPM operating agreement and you've done your diligence, and that you are giving the number that you're subscribing, the share class, and the titling of your name, right? It's basically saying, hey, how are you going to entitle your investment in this? And some people use living trust. Some people use their personal name. Some people use their LLC. Some people use their self-directed retirement account, their custodian account. And so this is just an agreement saying, I've read everything, I understand everything, and here's how much I'm going to invest, and here's how I'm going to invest it. And so that's really it. And sometimes subscription agreements will have a joinder agreement that is attached to it that you sign. And the joinder is really just adjoining you to the LLC or the operating company that you're investing in. And that's really kind of the documents you're going to see.
Excellent. I'm going to go through a couple things here in terms of titling. So like Ryan just said, you can invest via an individual, as a married couple, as an LLC, as a partnership, as a trust, as a self-directed IRA, all these things. So when you go on to a dashboard like ours or like Ryan's, and you're saying you're going through the subscription process of saying, I want to invest in this specific deal, the first thing the system will ask is, okay, how would you like to invest? On our system, that's called an investing account, and people can have as many accounts as they'd like. They can literally have an investment under every single one of those things I just listed off. When you get to the subscription agreement, there will be a series of boxes that you'll have to check to say, this is an entity as a single member LLC, a multi-member LLC, a C Corp, an SDIRA, a trust, and so on and so forth. I wanted to circle into the individuals because this can be confusing sometimes. There are individual, joint tenants with rights of survivorship, tenants in common, spouses as community property, spouses as community property with rights of survivorship, a married person as my sole and separate property. So you can see where some people might look at this and go, oh my God, I'm stuck, right?
We're going to go through this stuff, but here, can I just say, just before everyone, we lose everybody.
Absolutely.
We're not giving any tax, legal, or investment advice. Do your own due diligence. Talk to your tax and legal team. You can just invest in your name. You can just invest as Ryan individual. Gibson and all the, as an individual, right? That's all that means. So before we get into all these things that we can do, now you can invite or you can invest as a husband and wife, right? You can say Ryan and spouse, you know, can in last name can invest, right? So,
and this is usually joint tenants with rights of survivorship. So this is two or more people, often spouses or partners, equal interests in the asset. And when one owner dies, their share automatically transfers to the surviving owner without probate. That will require both social security numbers versus if you subscribe as an individual, it's just yours. However, keep in mind that unless you name a beneficiary specifically, that would go to probate upon your death.
That's right. And if both individuals are subscribing, they both, that as a joint venture, you have to be, or a joint couple, you have to meet the income qualifications to be, or the net worth qualifications to be accredited. So we'll transition into that in just a second, but I did want to, Yeah, that would bump you up to the 300K level if you didn't qualify on assets, you know, your net worth. But if you just did it in your individual name, you would only have to have 200K of income. We'll get into that, but there's some consequences to what you're doing. But keep going, Tate.
Absolutely. And keep in mind, you can always transfer these interests. So if you don't have a trust set up and eventually you want to transfer your interest, your limited partner interest into the trust later on, you just give us a call.
Bingo.
It's super easy. One page form.
Takes us 24 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say it takes us 5 minutes, but it might take 24 hours to turn it around. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's next? Tenants in common. So who's this for? Two or more people, including business partners or investors. The ownership can be unequal. There's no survivorship rights, but it's flexible in ownership splits. So less common. That's a much less common box to check. Next, spouses is community property. Who's this best for? Legally married couples in community property states like California, Texas, Arizona, Nevada. Both spouses own 50% of the property. And the implications here would be each spouse can will their 50% share to someone else unless changed by a trust or survivorship clause. So this may be subject to probate. Honestly, the most common thing I see is if you want to subscribe with a spouse, just go with joint tenants with rights of survivorship. Okay, we've beat this to death. Let's get to the accreditation. Yeah, is everybody confused now? Don't worry about it.
Personal name, you know, good to go.
Personal name or joint tenants works super easy.
Go get a trust, invest in your trust, call Anderson and have them set it up. You're good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So next is the accreditation. So Ryan, do I have to be an accredited investor in order to invest in one of these deals? The answer is usually yes.
Yes.
What does that mean? it means you have to be this tall to ride the ride.
Yep.
And that essentially, from the SEC's perspective, is you have to have either a $1 million net worth, excluding your primary residence, or income of over $200,000 per year for the prior 2 years, or $300K if you're doing it with your spouse.
And reasonably expect to make that income this year.
Correct. You can't knowingly be, you know, downgrading to FO. And yeah, I know somebody that did that.
So this, you know, I think people kind of really get wrapped around the axle about the accreditation thing, and it's really not a big deal. If you came to us right now and said, hey, I want to see if I'm accredited, we'd send you a link. You click on it, you upload a couple of things, and within 12 hours, you're going to know if you're accredited or not. This is not an application you got to go to, you know, go online or whatever and take a, you know, it's easy to get. And it's good for 90 days from the time that you pull it to the time that you put your money in. Then it's usually good for 5 years. So, you know, we've taken Turbine Capital, AICs into our syndications. You know, it's a thing that it's easy to get accredited. And there's so much technology now. We don't know what you make, by the way. We don't know how much net worth you have. It's a third party site. The rules are that you actually have to go to a third party, a disinterested third party, and it's got to be a legal opinion of, you know, a lawyer or financial advisor or CPA that's licensed and in good standing actually reviews it, and then they stamp out a letter.
Absolutely. So on our portal, if you go to settings, you find it there. Usually you don't want to get too far ahead of yourself because you don't want to have a letter and then you don't invest for 100 days and your letter's expired. You put us in a pinch. So just wait when you're going through the process. The second or third step will say, hey, are you an accredited investor? Yes. No. Do you need a letter? Yes. You upload some documents. I will say, all right, so this is getting into the nitty gritty. So number one, if you made less than $200,000, let's say for the tax year 2023, keep in mind that your 401k contributions count from the airline because they're 100% vested, right? So a lot of people that made $185,000, they're like, I'm not accredited. Well, go ahead back to your last pay stub of, say, 2023, whatever that first year that you're including in the 2 years. They have to be the prior 2 years, and you might end up being over that 200 mark. All you got to do is upload that as well, put a little note in the verifying thing, and the verifier will take that into account.
Yeah. Just a quick correction. A W-2 actually will show your contributions.
Okay.
Depending on how. There we go. Yeah. So you can actually go to your 401k. Because when you submit for the letter, you're going to probably, you know, if you're going to qualify an income, they're going to require you to upload a couple of W-2s from prior years. And there'll be a box. I can't remember which box it is. Box one, you know, will actually have your pre-tax 401k contributions, wages, tips, other compensation. And then box one and box two will actually show how much you contributed to the 401k. That's not the contribution, but this is the contributions that your employer made. So you'll actually have that all on your W-2. And then, of course, your current pay stub is going to have your year-to-date contribution. So anyway, keep going.
There we go. So, and of course, you can upload two W-2s or two December 31st paychecks or whatever it is that last. Anyway, you only need two documents. It makes it super
easy. Don't send them to us. Send them to the the third party vendor.
Yeah, we don't need to see it. We can't do anything with it. And you know, that keeps the confidentiality. The second part of this is that if you're going to verify with a spouse, you have to be $300,000 or more for the prior 2 years together jointly. Now, what people get screwed up is they think, oh, I'm married. I have to make over $300,000 with my spouse. And that's not the case. You can still qualify at the $200,000 level, but you just need to title your investment as an individual. But you can, let's say your spouse makes $150,000, you make $150,000, you are together accredited. Apart, neither is accredited, but you are together.
Or you make $300,000 or more and the spouse makes zero. That works as well.
Thank you. The You're next welcome. Thing that I'll mention is that qualifying via income is typically much easier than qualifying via net worth. The reason is that we typically see accreditations fail all the time. And it comes back and it says we need a full credit report because people just upload a brokerage account that has more than $1 million in it. They go, there you go. I'm worth more than $1 million. It's like, well, that does not take into account any debt. You could have a negative net worth if you had $2 million in debt and $1 million in assets. So they have to see a full picture of your net worth. And that's where not a credit score, that happens too. People upload a credit score, say, I've got a 780. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for a credit report that shows all of your debt positions so that they can then compare that to your assets. And so it's a little bit more of a pain to qualify via net worth than it is via income. Income's super easy, couple of W-2s and you're done.
Yeah. And again, your income or your net worth, you don't have to be both.
Correct.
So you could be worth $0 and make $300,000 for the last 2 years and expect to make it this year and you qualify. You could be worth, you know, over $1 million and make no income and still qualify. So
Thank you for clarifying that.
Are the two ways that the government has drawn a line in the sand. I like the Tate analogy of you got to be this tall to ride the ride. And that is where they've drawn the line. So it's either or.
You make this much or you're worth this much. We don't care if you go lose it. You make less than that, you can only invest in government regulated securities because we want to protect the little guy. At least that's the logic behind it. Okay. One other way to get accredited, I always want to preface this because sometimes I forget to mention this to people. If you have a CPA, an attorney, or a financial advisor, any one of those three that you have a great working relationship with, you can simply get them to sign a letter on your behalf, submit it to us or whatever other operator that you're investing with, and that suffices as well as long as their license number is on it with the date, signature. We have a template that we can provide you. I'm sure Spartan has the same. But occasionally people, when they're trying to jump through these net worth hurdles, I kind of just say, stop. Do you just have a financial advisor that would just sign this single page? And they're like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, let's just do that. That's so much easier. So just keep that in mind. But there are a lot of pilots that don't have a CPA. They're doing it through TurboTax. They don't have a financial advisor that's willing to sign it. And they don't have an attorney. So for those people, which is the vast majority, it's easier to just go through the electronic system.
So you go to this Houston thing and you're sitting on the bus and you go through all these properties and you say, okay, I want to invest. And you sign the subscription agreement on Tate's portal or our portal, wherever. And you get sent to this accredited investor portal. You upload your W-2s. You get approved. You sign the subscription agreement. You've read the documents. Thank you for reading the documents. And now you send in money. So you can ACH in funds through Tate's portal. On our portal, you can wire. You can mail checks. Please don't mail a check. But you can do both. So you wire in money and now you're in the deal. So now what happens, Tate?
Now what? Well, first thing that happens for us is you get a confirmation that your funds have been received. You will see those funds reflected on your dashboard. When you log in, you'll see that you have that contribution amount. Unlike investing in Bitcoin or stock, it's not very exciting after that. For the first 30 days, 60 days sometimes, you're waiting around, waiting till that first investor report comes out. Some deals report monthly. Some deals report quarterly. So we'll keep you updated on progress, you know, when the property closes, things that are happening. Typically distributions, if it's a cash flowing deal, those distributions will start anywhere from a quarter to 2 quarters after the deal closes. So you're really just kind of hanging out and waiting for that first investor report, waiting for that first distribution to hit. And obviously we'll put out all relevant communications, but depending on the deal, there just may not be all that much going on. And I think that's something that catches some people off guard when they're first investing in one of these deals, because they think, you know, they're used to checking their stock market portfolio like every day. They're like, what's new? What's happening? What? And it's like, nothing. That's why we're investing in real estate. It's boring.
Yeah. There's not going to be market changes and there's not going to be liquidity either. You're kind of stuck in the deal until the deal sells. A lot of people ask that. They say, well, what happens after 5 years? Well, that's the wrong question. You should say, well, what happens when the property sells? And the answer is, if there's enough to distribute, you get your principal back plus any upside or any returns that you're entitled to per the terms of the PPM and operating agreement, which those two documents will tell you exactly how those funds are divided up. And that's pretty much, you know, how it goes down. And I always say, you know, as an equity investor, as an LP, you're going to get a K-1, and don't plan on it coming on time. And what I mean by on time is don't plan on it coming before April 15th. So if you're doing these investments and you have a W-2 and you're doing only one of these investments and you're just a proud on time tax filer and you, you know, want to file your taxes in February or January or whenever you get your W-2, with these type of investing, you're not going to be able to file typically before April 15th. So you're going to have to file an extension. And that's just one of the downsides, I think. But I do want to be upfront with people that that's typically how it goes. And so don't be disappointed when, you know, you're filing your taxes in June or July.
You can always extend and amend. Extend or amend, right? You know, we get people doing both. If you have a massive refund waiting for you and you just can't wait to file, you can always file an amendment later if you just really want to do it.
Always says it's better to extend than amend. So, and you know, there's some great advice out there that if you extend your taxes, you reduce the risk of audit because the quota prior to April 15th is there. And so people, you know, typically there's a lot lower likelihood of an audit. Now, again, I'm not guaranteeing anything or whatever. This is just friendly conversation, but that's typically the case.
We've got lots of episodes that talk about those late K-1s. Go back. We talked about pros and cons of syndication investing. You check that out. This was more of a nuts and bolts episode, but that's essentially the process.
That's it.
That's it. So kind of in summary here, the operators in this space work really, really hard. They work day in and day out to find and vet and structure the opportunities that you then get presented. And it's your job to decide whether you'd like to be in or like to be out. You don't have to invest in anything. We have investors that have been on our list for 5+ years, have never touched a thing. We've got other investors that have been in every deal that we've ever done almost. So it's really up to you. You can diversify as much as you want across different operators, different geographies, different deals. And at the end, it's your portfolio and it's your choosing. We're out there working as hard as we possibly can to curate the best possible opportunities that we can for our investors. I know, Ryan, you guys are the same, and we're proud to partner with you on a great number of deals at this point, including this Houston deal, which is very interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we, you know, really are just excited to open up the kimono, as they say, and let people in and talk about this deal. And, you know, we really look forward to those that are coming out next week, and we're going to be having a blast. And if, like I said, if you can't make the bus side, no big deal, 4:30 Taulier Brewing down in Sugar Land, Texas, we'll have an awesome happy hour. If you want details on just the happy hour, reach out to us. No big deal. You can come to that. You don't need to be on the bus tour to go to the happy hour or anything like that. We'd love to see you. We'd love to meet you and put a name to the face.
PassiveIncomePilots.com/Houston to RSVP or reach out to either Ryan or myself. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you on the next one.